from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up in this morning's opening forum hour on Tuesday, Twitter banned Breitbart tech editor Milo Yiannopoulos from its platform in response to an ongoing barrage of racist and sexist comments directed against Ghostbusters star Leslie Jones. In a statement, Twitter said, quote, "No one deserves to be subjected to targeted abuse online, and our rules prohibit inciting or engaging in the targeted abuse or harassment of others." Yiannopoulos, who gained notoriety when he wrote in defense of gamers during the Gamergate controversy, accused Twitter of waging a culture war that he claimed would infringe on free speech and conservative voices. We take up the issue in the hour ahead after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's forum program. On Tuesday, Twitter made a rare move. It permanently banned from its service Milo Yiannopoulos, the tech editor of the conservative news site Breitbart, after a star of the new Ghostbusters film, African-American actress Leslie Jones, reported that Milo and his followers flooded her Twitter account with thousands of racist and sexist comments. Twitter stated that it does not tolerate this kind of targeted abuse, but some argue that the company has not been tough enough in cracking down on trolls and online harassment. Others worry that Twitter has too much power as a company to limit what people say and that cutting off one user is a slippery slope to keeping others from freely expressing themselves. We take up the issue in this morning's opening forum hour, and let me tell you who is joining us for the hour. We want to welcome, first of all, from Washington, D.C., Soraya Shamali, who is director of the Women's Media Center Speech Project, and we welcome you to the program. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you, Michael.
We also want to welcome Cindy Cohen, who is here with us in studio, Executive Director of the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Welcome to the program.
Morning.
Good morning to you. And Arati Shahani, who is NPR's tech reporter and who has been covering the story. And Arati, good to have you with us as well. Thank you for being here.
Hi.
So maybe we can get you to begin outlining us what actually took place here. This is all over the movie Ghostbusters?
It's never all over a movie. We've learned that time and again. So what it looks like took place, what we do know, and then, you know, I'll talk a little bit about what we don't know. What we do know is it looks like, you know, right before this happened, Leslie Jones was doing well. She was actually on the game show Match Game, hosted by Alec Baldwin, having a good time, Whatnot tweeted about that. And then next we see the following morning, this is Monday morning around 9:12 a.m., she tweets out that she's being harassed and she's being called all sorts of names and she's blocking people. But then what we see over the course of the next few hours is that she's beginning to retweet the kinds of offensive things that are being tweeted at her. She's being called an ape. She's being called the N-word repeatedly. She says she got a picture photoshopped with semen on her face. Offensive things that would rile up anyone. And what she did was basically begin to then respond very vigilantly against it, tweeting up to every minute. Now, somewhere in all of that, I mean, so that trolling campaign happened. That's clearly, you know, it clearly went down on Twitter. People saw it. People tuned into it. Interestingly enough, one source that I interviewed yesterday say that the way he even stumbled into it is that he saw that Leslie Jones was trending. So it was a feature of Twitter itself that prompted him to go and look at what was happening at the sort of brawl. Now, in the midst of all that, one person in particular, a man named Milo Yiannopoulos, who is very well known. He's a tech editor.
There's 300,000 Twitter followers, in fact.
Yeah. So he's very popular. Some people say he's a very well-known troll. People have very different takes on him. He's definitely a personality, that's for sure. So Milo gets on, and what we see is him having an exchange with Leslie Jones. He's critical of her movie. He says that she's basically a complainer. What we don't see is him actually tweeting vile, like the sort of the kinds of things that would clearly violate terms of service, like the N-word or things like that. But the question here then is, Twitter decided to go ahead and suspend his account permanently. and over this incident, we don't know then why they decided in this incident to go ahead and terminate his account.
Well, there's been a history. He was suspended a couple of times, wasn't he, in June from Twitter?
He's
and he had a privileged account as well?
A verified account, exactly, yeah. And that was taken away as well. So he's been reprimanded in the past. You know, as a reporter just looking at this, I'm very curious to know what exactly happened. Like, did he go to other platforms and incite people to come onto Twitter and you know, harass Jones? Like, what was the role there that Twitter sees? Twitter, in a statement that they released, wouldn't give any details about the specific suspension or even details about what happened with Leslie Jones. What we know is that at some point on Monday evening, Jack Dorsey, Twitter CEO, saw Jones tweeting about this. Jones tweeted to Twitter, "Hey, can you guys do something? This is out of control." And Dorsey tweeted her directly, "Hey, I follow you. Please direct message me, DM me, and let's talk about it." So clearly Twitter went ahead and took action, which is, you know, some would say an unusual thing to see Twitter do. There was a fairly prompt response that Jack Dorsey himself sort of weighed in is not the usual at all.
Isn't the question here, though, how much really Milo as opposed to his followers had to do with this? Where was the line drawn?
I think that there's absolutely a question about that. And I think that, you know, Twitter is not currently talking about what they believe the role of Milo was. In the statement that they issued, they wouldn't even refer to the specific incident around Leslie Jones. They just, you know, restated that harassment is really an issue and abuse is an issue that they're trying to deal with. They said they're going to be issuing new policies soon to reduce the burden on the targeted person to be able to report it. But they wouldn't talk about this instance in particular.
And we should say that we asked Twitter to join us for this hour. We never heard back from them. But go back a little bit with us, if you could, Arthi. This goes back to Gamergate. I mean, in terms of the whole evolution of this, didn't it all start with Gamergate?
Well, I mean, the key thing about Gamergate, as we talk about this piece of news, is that Milo Yiannopoulos and Hart made a name for himself or grew a following for himself around his defense of Gamergate and exposition of what he described as journalists who were basically in cahoots with the sort of extremist feminists who were, you know, trying to take over the gaming community. So Yiannopoulos, at that point, writing for Breitbart, he had published basically these leaked documents showing conversations happening in a media list for game reporters and showing that they seemed to be not objective, not dispassionate, but really siding with a side. And so he gave Gamergate a kind of legitimacy that it hadn't, that prior to Gamergate was just described as a group of anonymous trolls attacking women in gaming. And he came in and did something different to the narrative.
And again, Arthi Shahani is tech reporter for NPR. Let me go to Cindy Cohen, who's also with us here in studio, executive director of the Electronic Frontier Foundation. I was reading an article about the 25th employee, Cindy Del Harvey. That's not her real name, but she's called the head of the Troll Patrol. And it's her job with about how many billion of tweets, half a billion maybe tweets coming in a day to sort of go through them and decide which should be prohibited and which should be allowed and so forth. I remember, you may remember Jeff Rosen, who wrote about this early on and wrote about the big meeting at Stanford between the, what he called the delete squad. I mean, a lot of power is invested in individuals to make subjective decisions. And we get right at the kernel of a kind of free speech issue here, although this is a corporation. This isn't the government, right? It's not, so where does Electronic Frontier see this in terms of free speech and First Amendment rights?
Well, I think you put your finger on one of the things that we're most concerned about, which is that corporations are really not very good at deciding what speech should happen and what speech should not. They're not good at it for some professional reasons, but in the case of Twitter or Facebook, some of they're not good at it because the sheer scale of the speech that they're expected to evaluate in an instant without any context a lot of the times is just too big. I don't think it's, you know, I think that there are, you know, some of the companies have really stepped up. They had some pretty lame efforts beginning and they're starting to move forward. But it's an impossible task. Corporations are not going to be able to be, especially, you know, what I like to say is, you know, a bunch of people based in India who've had, you know, 3 weeks of training are really not the kinds of folks who are capable of understanding what's going on in a lot of these fights.
Plus, a lot of this is subjective by nature, isn't it?
Well,
in terms of who's going to determine what is over the line or not.
It's contextual.
Yeah, it's contextual. Yeah. I mean, one of the things that we do is we work with a lot of people around the world who are using these tools to try to get their voice heard. And we see that a lot of these tools that are set up to try to stop harassment end up getting misused. In the Israeli-Palestine fight, for instance, there's an incident that started what we ended up doing, which was a website called onlinecensorship.org, where a Coldplay Facebook page had a posting from a Palestinian group, and it had 7,000 comments. Most people were favorable to it. It ended up getting taken down by Facebook because of complaints that it was hate speech. This is a political fight, right, between Palestine and Israel, and that goes back and forth, and there's all sorts of people. But the people at Facebook were supremely unqualified to decide who's right and who ought to be able to speak and who shouldn't be able to speak. We see the same problem in the Ukraine, for instance, where a lot of the people who are talking about Ukrainian independence get accused of being Nazis by the Russians. It happens, you know, China has lots of this, where there are people who go around and complain that anybody who says things that the government doesn't like are violating the terms of service. And so putting a corporation in the situation where they're supposed to decide who's a Nazi and who's a Ukrainian independence person, who's a legitimate Palestinian voice, who's not, they can't do that, and they'll never be able to do it. So while it's important for the companies can take some steps here, I think they're always going to be vulnerable to the criticism that they don't understand enough about the situation to be able to make the right decision. And when you magnify that by the amount of speech that they're supposed to be evaluating every second, it's an impossible task.
And yet you hear and you read supposedly that Facebook, for example, has tougher and clearer standards, at least that they try to hew to. And for example, Instagram acted rather quickly at some harassment of Taylor Swift. There's a real difference in terms of each company on its own.
Well,
it appears.
I'm not so sure. I mean, maybe. I certainly think that what we're beginning, you know, I think it would be a sad thing if what we ended up happening is that celebrities get quick attention and non-celebrities don't. And I think that's where things are trending.
Leslie Jones being a celebrity.
Exactly. And so what did she hear from? She heard from the president of Twitter. I think that, you know, I don't cry any tears for Milo, but I think we have to think about what kind of rules do we want in these situations. And I worry actually more about the situations that don't involve celebrities than the ones that do.
Well, let me bring Soraya Ashamali into this. And Soraya Ashamali is the director of the Women's Media Center Speech Project. And you've been very critical of Twitter for its, not only lack of coherence and responsiveness, but also lack of transparency.
Yes, I think that, you know, as Cindy just mentioned, there tends to be a pattern of Twitter responding when there are celebrities involved. I've worked very closely with Facebook and on individual cases, sometimes on a daily basis, people who are being harassed and threatened or are in a very dangerous situation. And I can honestly say that by point of comparison, even though those people may not be famous or have access to media, Facebook responds very quickly. But Facebook also has been doing this longer and I think has invested more in terms of people and infrastructure in being responsive to a civil society and advocacy groups.
Well, there are different cultures.
That doesn't mean we're not.
I mean, isn't that the case? We're talking about different cultures here, virtually.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think, you know, you can really see that. And I mean, Jack Dorsey jumped in and he had this interaction. And sometimes you do see that. You see where CEOs in very problematic cases step into a breach. And honestly, for the people who are tasked with doing this work on a daily basis, that is often a real problem internally because they're the people most familiar with what's going on. They're the ones who are having to deal with the difficulties of implementing and mediating policies. And so, yes, they're very different cultures and they have very, very different responses to things like this.
And Twitter now has Periscope, which I think you've said is rife with harassment, too.
Well, yeah, I mean, this is one of the issues with how you can try and gauge institutional responses. I mean, many organizations, coalitions, individuals have been working with Twitter at various levels in different capacities to address this type of harassment in Twitter. And so last fall, Twitter set up its Safety and Trust Advisory Board with about 40 organizations on it. But almost simultaneously, Periscope was released, and what's very clearly happening in Periscope, particularly if you look at women is that there's this kind of explosive digital analog to street harassment, where a woman is using Periscope and she could be doing anything. She could be live streaming a pot of water boiling, and a steady stream of extremely sexualized and sometimes pornographic commentary will profusely flood her stream. And so, again, what you have here is the creation of a product that, with some forethought or even input from people that Twitter is now working with, might have created a different type of product, a product that didn't lend itself so easily to that kind of harassment and abuse.
Is it safe to say that Twitter, if you can draw this kind of conclusion, is more concerned about the number of tweets and the profit than they are about the content of what's said? Is that a general rule? You want to come in here, Arti?
Yeah, I mean, I would just point out that, for example, Periscope recently changed policy to try to deal with the kind of trolling you see over there. So what they did was, it's not like trying to algorithmically spot pornographic or hate speech or things like that, but it's just introducing a jury of your peers. So you flag content and a jury of five people decide, okay, should you, you know, do they agree or not? And it's, you know, it's basically trying to crowdsource again the regulation of the platform. And I think that that little tweak in Periscope, as well as tweaks you're seeing in Twitter and Facebook, I mean, I think what it shows is ultimately all of these social networks, all these platforms, they're trying to get people on it. And then they're growing up and realizing, oh, we've got to do something to regulate and take measures to protect. You know, I'll give you an example. Facebook, you know, Cindy, you were mentioning these various countries where there's been, you know, clear using of their flagging policies by one political camp against another. Here in the U.S., when we had that week of three shootings, right, I learned from sources inside Facebook that the company was basically seeing this enormous spike in the flagging of things that were considered hate speech by users. And it was basically a flagging war going on. And the people here at Facebook did not know how to deal with it. According to people inside the company, they were going back and forth. I spoke to people whose content was taken down and wasn't taken down. And what you basically see is, okay, well, who are the people deciding this? There's sort of a few points to make here. One is that when you look at who's deciding in their community standards group whether something's hate speech or not, what you see via LinkedIn search is people with, you know, relatively freshly out of college, which with, you know, bachelor's degrees in math and comp sci, sort of an array of things. And they are training those people, giving them trainings. But the point is, these deciding what hate speech is. I mean, I go to my senior editor to give me feedback on that. How is someone who doesn't even have a context for this going to decide? You know, and then the other point I'll just make on this then is that I don't envy the challenge that they have, which is ultimately it is actually very relatively easy to flag content. It is relatively hard to decide whether that content does or doesn't violate. So just to sort of
– Actually, Jeff Rosen, who I alluded to earlier, said some of these people have more power than judges or even the president. That's not necessarily hyperbolic. I mean, in terms of making these decisions that certainly have a great deal of impact politically and in other ways. But Cindy Cohen, when you ban someone, as Twitter did, like Milo Yiannopoulos, I mean, can't he just take another Twitter account out under another name? It's sort of a whack-a-mole thing, isn't it?
Well, it can be a whack-a-mole thing. I think Twitter's getting – this is definitely one of the issues, these sock puppet things. I don't know that that's what will happen here because he's a pretty high-profile person. And Twitter is getting better at having tools to help them try to shut down those that's what verified accounts are a part of what they're trying to do. I mean, there's lots of things that these, you know, I do think that trying to pit Twitter against Facebook, I mean, you know, in this kind of thing, all of these big social networks have these problems. And you know, they also all have the problem that their processes are very opaque. There's not a lot of transparency. People don't often know why things get taken down. This is a problem in Facebook too. I think Facebook has developed some good individual relationships with people who can feed them information about things. But the process as a whole is still pretty much a black box. And that's why we started onlinecensorship.org, which was to try to begin to collect information from people who are being affected by these policies so we can kind of reverse engineer and figure out what these companies are doing. It would be far better if they took steps to be more transparent about what they're doing. I mean, they all have terms of service, but they're all pretty vague.
And let me read an example. We do not, this is from Twitter, we do not tolerate behavior that, excuse me, crosses into abuse, including behavior that is harassing, intimidating, or uses fear to induce, to influence another one's user's voice, induce another user's voice. In fact, Soraya, let me go back to you, Soraya Shamali, just to get your sense of, weren't there recommendations made to Twitter from to their advisory board? They were, I think, not necessarily.
They have, I think. There definitely have been recommendations made to Twitter, some of which I think they have incorporated, and they've made some product changes since late 2014. But again, as all of us have kind of been dancing around, the problem is very complicated. There are not solutions so far that are really scalable. And, you know, when you're dealing with a million reports a day, the only way that a corporation can deal with that is to try and impose some standard benchmark for moderation. But the minute they get into that business, they become arbiters of norms. And what Jeff Rosen talks about, which is this free speech imperialism, is a significant worry, right? Because as we know, individual human beings are writing rules about free speech. They are not necessarily equipped to do that. And then a whole other set of individual human beings are looking at things and trying to make decisions. And
well, should the public be brought into this? Do you think the public should be brought into this in some way?
I actually think that what we need is far more public understanding of things like digital citizenship, of the First Amendment, of our own digital labor, of our role as digital laborers. Because when you look at what Periscope has done, where they have this jury of your peers, in point of fact, it's very rare that you're going to ever get a jury of peers. And we know the demographics on these platforms. Some of them are very, very skewed. And so what will happen is that a jury like that, more likely than not, is going to establish, reproduce, and amplify some pretty status quo supporting rules on their own. That's kind of a default, right? And is that really how we want to be doing this? Probably not, because people who are already marginalized in public space, whether it's offline or on, are again going to be subject to dominant norms that kind of rely on precedent and tradition and bias and all of these other things.
Well, we've certainly raised a lot of significant questions, I think, in relationship to this latest episode that we are focusing on. And in fact, we're talking about Twitter's recent move to ban Milo Yiannopoulos, the tech editor for the conservative news site Breitbart, after Ghostbusters star Leslie Jones reported a flood of online abuse from Yiannopoulos and his followers. And you think Twitter made the right move? And how should social media sites like Twitter and Facebook draw the line on when to ban someone? Or should anyone have the right to say whatever they want online? Give us a call. If you have something you'd like to add to this conversation, you can call us at 866-733-6786. That's a toll-free number, 866-733-6786. You can also email questions or comments to forum at kqed.org or post them on our website, kqed.org/forum, or you can tweet us. Our Twitter handle is at @kqedforum. We welcome your involvement. Like to hear from you, whatever your thoughts are and whatever your questions or comments are. So feel free again to join the program. Twitter banning Breitbart editor after the Ghostbusters actress was flooded with online abuse. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. And welcome back to Forum. We're talking about Twitter's recent move to ban Milo Yiannopoulos, the tech editor, the conservative news site Breitbart, after Ghostbusters star Leslie Jones reported a flood of online abuse from Yiannopoulos and his followers. And do you think Twitter made the right move? And how should social media sites like Twitter and Facebook draw the line on when to ban someone? Or should anyone have the right to say whatever they want online? Please give us a call if you'd like to join the program. It's toll-free, 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. Or you can email questions to forum at kqed.org or post them onto our website at kqed.org/forum. NPR's tech reporter, Aarti Shahani, is with us in studio, and so is Cindy Cohen from the Electronic Frontier Foundation. She's the executive director there, and we have online with us Soraya Shamali, who is director of the Women's Media Center Speech Project. She's with us from the nation's capital. I just wonder, Aarti, if you could maybe give us a little more sense of Why ban Yiannopoulos? I mean, what did Twitter say specifically about banning him? Trying to, again, get to that question of how much he's responsible for orchestrating things as opposed to, you know, his followers or people who he stirred up, maybe.
You know, oh my God, the honest answer is I can't tell you why Twitter banned Yiannopoulos in particular. They refused to talk about it even on background. They gave a statement they wouldn't take a call even to discuss this on background. What we do know is that, you know, he got into basically a bit of a tweeting match with Leslie Jones, but it doesn't appear that he said anything that was overtly, you know, sort of aggressive or offensive in that way. I do believe he retweeted as well some false tweets. Something else that was happening, this is actually an interesting part of the story, is that at some point people started photoshopping fake tweets from Leslie Jones where she uses she disparages homosexuals and whatnot, and basically fake tweets that make it look like, oh, this is coming from Leslie Jones's account, just screenshots, no links to the original tweets, just screenshots, and making it look like, no, she's the aggressive, hateful one. So he retweeted some of that stuff. You know, that in itself being the thing to deactivate him. I mean, the fact is, you know, as Cindy was mentioning, this black box of decision making, it completely applies in this instance as well.
I know there's no logic to this, but you would think that if there was anger about Ghostbusters and so forth, it might be directed at the casting directors or the producers rather than an actress who's just playing a role in a movie.
Well, I mean, you know, it's never just about the movie, right? And so, like, the conflict over Ghostbusters is a reflection of things happening in society.
This is supposed to be, at least initially, it was described as or characterized as some kind of a culture war against female domination or things along those lines, which has been, you know, part of the whole narrative.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to our callers, and let's begin with Misha, who's joining us from Oakland this morning. Misha, welcome. You're on the air.
Good morning. I would just like to ask about platforms like Twitter and Facebook kind of censoring conservative voices, whether for hate speech or just differing opinions. Do you think these platforms should hold an obligation for transparency in their decision-making?
Cindy Cohen?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that there needs to be more transparency in their decision-making. I also think that one of the big problems here is that these systems are set up such that Twitter controls when the takedowns happen, and Twitter controls has to make all of these decisions. I think that if Twitter and some of these other platforms are willing to open up their APIs, have much more configurable blocking, and let people decide for themselves how they want to see this by giving them better tools and letting people develop tools that interact with the system, then Twitter wouldn't have all this responsibility. You could subscribe to somebody's service that helps you decide what part of how you want to look at Twitter. But, you know, these systems are really, they're not made so that they interoperate very well. Twitter decides which controls you get and which controls you don't get. But Twitter doesn't have to be designed that way.
Soraya Shamali, let's have you weigh in on this.
I agree. I think that what we're seeing a lot of the tension between what constitutes policy and what makes a product. And so if you're going to actually be relying on users to act in these ways, to make these decisions, they need much better tools to be able to do that. And over again, what we see is companies trying to push those decisions back onto users' shoulders so that they themselves are not these intermediaries. I think if you asked any of these people, they would gladly walk away from the job of moderation. It's hugely expensive.
Let me bring on more callers here. Let me go to Dan next. Dan, you're on. Good morning.
Two questions. When these platforms reach this scale, are they really, shouldn't they be really public utilities? And secondly, that's actually the question I have. We'll leave it at that.
All right, let's leave it at that. Public utilities, Cindy Cohen?
I'm uncomfortable using that kind of framing for basically user side thing. I'm trying to see if I can figure out how to talk about the difference between the different stacks on the internet. I'm not sure that turning them into public utilities is the right way to go. I think people deserve the ability to vote with their feet, and we need to make tools better so that people can leave, they can take their data with them, or they can configure these devices, these tools in ways that serve them. More configurable blocking, more tools that let you do the right thing and choose your experience rights on Twitter would be better than trying to then turn them into publicly regulated spaces. There's a whole lot of problems in trying to bring that in that I think would end up making the cure a little worse than the disease, perhaps.
Soraya Shamali, let me go back to you because you talked about how labor-intensive moderation is and how it's not profitable for companies. Can we dig a little more into that from your perspective?
Sure. There are now, by some some people estimate that there are hundreds of thousands of people around the world that are doing this work of moderation. And so in some instances, companies have their own staff. In other instances, they have contractors. In third, they have third-party companies that are doing this kind of moderation. And so this work is being strung together with really no standards, no guidelines. We're 10 to 12 years in now, and the people who've had the longest tenure understand what these problems are and are coming together outside of the frameworks of these companies to try and find better solutions. But it is extremely expensive, and it's intensely human. I mean, I think many people think that this work is being done primarily algorithmically or through automation, and it just isn't managed that way. And so it is. It's hugely expensive.
Well, I've got a caller who's on point here. Catherine, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, yes, thanks for taking my call. I just had 2 points. I work for one of the largest online health communities. We're based in San Francisco. And 2 points. One is to Michael, you mentioned earlier about the idea of whack-a-mole, and if you just take out one user, does that really do anything? And I think it does. You need to send a message down that you set a culture for what you expect of your communities. And I think if Twitter were to take that step more firmly, you would set a culture for what is tolerated and is not tolerated. And I think you have to have an opinion on that as a company. And 2, in terms of moderation, I know the point brought up earlier about the scalability of moderation. We, at our online health community, we support 18 million users a month. But we invest in our moderation, and it's a combination of technology as well as people. And there are people that are employed by us or are volunteers. We don't throw it back on the user. We take an active role in determining what we feel crosses the line. If someone has breached our terms of service, they're temporarily banned, and if they are suspended, and if they do it multiple times, they're banned from the site, and we monitor their IP addresses to make sure that they don't come back on their fake usernames. So I think it seems to me like Twitter's trying to sidestep a lot of the responsibility that they take as an online open platform.
All right, Catherine, I thank you for those comments. Appreciate hearing from you, and we're going to go right to another caller here. We'll get Patrick on next. Patrick, thanks for waiting. You're on.
Oh, hello. How's it going? I just quickly wanted to say that I listened to Milo on Joe Rogan's podcast a little bit ago, and he's just like a troll level 30. He's great at what he does, and I don't know if he should be banned or not from Twitter, but I definitely think that's kind of playing into his hand. His followers on Breitbart are definitely, you know, he can just point to that as sort of, you know, he can make himself a martyr. See, I got banned from Twitter. See, conservative speech is...
I think he's in Cleveland at the Republican convention. He said he was delighted by this because it's going to get him more attention. I mean, I think he's on record as saying words to that effect, at least.
Mm-hmm. I think he's doing the Donald Trump playbook where it's like I will say something until the media picks it up because I mean you kind of have to be responsible and you have to cover it, I feel like, but then that just gets them more coverage.
Yeah, he calls Trump daddy. In fact, that's also on the record. Thank you for the call, Patrick. I want to get to another caller here. That's Phil. Phil, you're on.
Hi. So spam is something that Google can handle. You know, I get no spam on Gmail because they can see that the spammers are hitting all these different people. And it seems to me that trolls and spammers are kind of similar. Why can't they just be identified and handled? Why are they different?
Shani, you want to make that distinction?
I think that's a great question, and I think it's sort of a question that floats around a lot. The way that you identify whether something is spam, you can technologically do it. You can sort of identify, oh, this is coming from one place that's doing this mass mailing. You can actually identify it algorithmically. When it's an individual person posting something that could be hateful, that could be a criticism of something hateful. So, for example, one of the most controversial images that was on Facebook in the aftermath of those shootings was a picture of a person in a black hood slitting the throat of a police officer. Okay. And it was actually a cartoon image, not a photograph. And You know, the head of Facebook policy, Monica Bicker, I interviewed her about her company's handling of that image. And what she pointed out is, listen, that image on a post that's advocating the killing of officers is not permissible. That image in a post that's mourning this kind of violence or hate is permissible. And so you can't have an algorithm say, oh, look, this is a cop killer photo. We can't have it. And so that's part of the problem with automating these. You can't do that.
And let me thank the caller and go to some of your comments online here and that are coming in by email. Listener writes, speech about groups, no matter how hateful, is the price we pay for free speech. Targeted abuse of an individual like this is essentially a form of assault and should be totally unacceptable. Another listener writes, seems to me that Silicon Valley is libertarian when it comes to profits, but authoritarian when it comes to free speech. Could there be a worse combination? After all, this is what China is like. And here's a tweet from Craig who says, this issue seems like a solved problem. Harmful fake tweets are covered to libel laws by libel laws, and avoiding the public entirely is solved by making one's account protected. Well, are there enough protections in place, Cindy Cohen?
Well, I think this points out a couple of underlying issues that are important for us to talk about this and not just focus on Twitter. We have a couple of and these things. Law enforcement still does a horrible job with harassment. And it especially does a hard time with digital harassment. And so people who try to go to law enforcement to get help for these kinds of things often find that law enforcement isn't capable of really responding correctly. I mean, this is, you know, marginalized people getting help from the cops when they're being harassed is a problem that predates the internet and continues to happen. And so when you layer the digital on top of it, the cops just throw up their hands and really aren't able to assist. So we definitely, if we're looking at places where we can begin to respond to this, I think we can start by getting law enforcement better able to understand what's going on in the digital environment and react to harassment and real threats in a way that gives people a sense of protection. One of the things that the companies could do in this regard is make it easier for targets to be able to use what happens to them online as evidence. Often it's very difficult to recreate what happened to you in a way that you can show the authorities how this harassment happened and how it went. And I think the companies could take some steps to be able to basically have chain of custody and evidence preservation tools that let people put the packet together that they're going to need to show the cops when they've been harassed and let the cops do their jobs. So this is another place that people can look when they're concerned about this, that we could shore up the protections we give people under law already, because it's true. Making true threats against people is already illegal. Fraud, pretending to be somebody you're not in a way that hurts them, is already illegal. We have lots of laws that will address this situation, but they're frankly not being used very well right now.
And apropos of what we just heard from Cindy Cohen, Arthi Shahani, I'm looking at another listener comment here. Well, it's actually a question. Max writes, the response from Twitter is totally non-transparent. This is the company that owns what has literally become a major realm of our society. What's the best and fairest system for handling harassment that you've seen? And I guess it goes right to the question, is there a network or is there a company that moderates well?
I mean, the major platforms, I think, are all struggling with how to moderate. I think that this is the problem that we're seeing across the board. I do think that there are these smaller solutions, like Cindy just mentioned, for example. Like, take the Leslie Jones case. One thing that happened is all of these fake tweets being retweeted and retweeted. And then according to some of the people who are witnessing this, jumping in themselves, who I interviewed yesterday, they said during the course of it, they also noticed things were being deleted. So like they saw a tweet one moment and then it was deleted the next. If Leslie Jones was not a celebrity, you know, on Twitter's radar, and she then wanted to go ahead and seek some kind of justice with publicly available tools, law enforcement and the criminal justice system to do that, then what would she do? How would she find those deleted tweets? How would she be able to recover that? So I think that's a really great point that you make. Separately from that, and this is not just about harassment, but in terms of tools that are available that could be integrated more vigorously, there's, for example, Snopes, right? Snopes basically tags articles that may be false that are being, you know, links that are being shared online. One person I spoke to who's a former Facebook employee said, why couldn't Facebook go ahead and algorithmically, use what Snopes has tagged, because Snopes is a reliable source, to go ahead and automate the tagging of things that look false.
But you know, Snopes has also been criticized for partisan politics, too.
Okay, so fair enough. The spirit of the comment stands, which is that if you have tools that are available that audit fraudulent content, why not automate the use of that information so that you stop the spread of rumors? The point is, Facebook's tools are not particularly sophisticated in this area, and former employees think they could be.
Well, let me get, speaking of former employees, let me get Scott on the air here, because Scott wants to bring up the woman who was harassed severely in Gamergate. Go ahead, Scott.
Hi. So I know in February of 2016, Twitter founded the Trust and Safety Council, which is kind of a moderation censorship board. And on this board is Anita Sarkeesian, who is probably the figurehead of the attacks for Gamergate, which made Milo so controversial. I was wondering how much of this is fair moderation concerning his recent tweets, and how much of this is kind of a human grudge that's spread out over years.
Well, that casts a whole different light on it, potentially. Soraya Shamali, let's get you in this.
So I think, first of all, it's an interesting description, right? A moderation censorship board, because the implication is that Anita and her cohorts have been plotting against Milo to have him kicked off for months because they personally don't like what he has to say. And I think that that probably is an unfair description of the situation. The board itself is comprised of 40 organizations. The company sometimes listens to them and sometimes doesn't. It's really entirely up to them. They are an unpaid group of advisors that the company relies on when it needs to have certain questions answered. But the Gamergate situation in particular speaks directly to the problem of how this abuse is recognized, because very rarely at this scale is it one human being. We're talking about organized cross-platform harassment where a networked group of people decide that they're going to assault or attack usually one individual, sometimes not. And what Twitter is able to do, what Facebook is able to do, is to see how those networks function. So in this instance, it's really not transparent why they decided to ban Milo. But I would suspect that what they're able to see is that what he does and says has the ability to flip the switch on a malevolent group of actors that do engage in the kind of whack-a-mole creation of accounts. And law enforcement is particularly inhibited, not just by their lack of exposure or understanding, but by things like jurisdiction. So, you know, a woman politician in England is getting the majority of her rape and death threats from men in the United States. There's nothing that the police in England can do about that, right? And there's nothing that the police in the United States can do about it when it's spread all over the country. So it's really complicated. I think that right now conservatives are feeling censored, but every single group or organization that you can talk to would have an experience or an anecdote where they themselves feel the same way. And so I think it goes back to this question of what is moderation? Who is writing these rules? What kind of standards are there, and how are these corporations being governed?
And again, Soraya Shamali with us from D.C. is director of the Women's Media Center Speech Project. Let me read some more comments here. Thaddeus writes, Twitter is a private service, has the right to ban whomever they want. However, every service that goes down this path ends up losing big because there's no good way to moderate, and it's incredibly subjective. The real solution is to harden up and stop getting upset at words on a computer screen. Calling in the authorities when someone says something you don't like is childish. Carmen writes, while collectively we embrace free speech, I think we often overlook the fact that social media represents new spaces we inhabit. Polluting a person's Twitter page is not unlike repeatedly screaming outside someone's home window. We live in these spaces, and it's not as simple as arguing freedom of speech. Suzanne writes, how is it defensible that Twitter would censor provocateurs for breach of their code of conduct and not aggressively censor ISIS and other terrorist groups? Twitter is currently the primary platform for ISIS propaganda and recruitment, amounting to material support for terrorist organizations, something explicitly illegal and certainly breaching their standards of conduct.
Cynical? Yeah, I don't think that I don't think we would want a world in which an open platform that lets lots of people speak can be held responsible under the material support for terrorism law. In fact, there's a Supreme Court case that would disagree with that legal conclusion that somebody said. And I think it's, while I don't like lots of things about that decision, it's the right one in terms of that. I think that the caller's point points out the problem in these companies being setting themselves up and society expecting them to be the arbiters of speech, which is they're always going to be hypocrites, right? They're always going to make a decision in one place that can be attacked because they didn't make the same decision in another. Now, Twitter's done quite a bit actually to try to pull ISIS off of the platform, but they're never going to succeed. And so they're always going to be vulnerable to the criticism that, well, how come you reacted here when you didn't react there? And that's why we need to, I think, start thinking about ways to not put them in the position
you've
of
just
being
given
as arbiters.
A great justification for the idea that they can't necessarily have a coherent policy.
That's right. And so I don't think that they shouldn't be the place where the policy gets set. I think that they need to give tools to users to allow users to control what they see and to work together to try to decide what kind of experience they want to have on Twitter. These platforms need to be opened up to let people have more control over what kinds of things they see.
It's ironic because from the other side you're hearing, of course, they need to be less open. Arthur, you want to weigh in?
It's also just interesting to me because, you know, Cindy, effectively what I hear you saying is the lack of sophistication, the lack of development of of a strategy that is actually manageable, whether it's opening up, being less hierarchical. And at the same time, you also see these platforms moving to help us share more visceral, more emotive content, like the whole live video move by Twitter, by Facebook. I mean, live video, the point of it is to catch you, you know, and pull your heartstrings. And so my concern is actually we'll see more of this before we see less of it.
Well, but I think you've got to recognize that this medium always has a light side and a dark side, let's just say. I mean, you know, Periscope let members of Congress continue to show the world what was going on Congress's floor when they pulled the plug on C-SPAN, right? Periscope was what the members of Congress did when they were engaged in this protest. Turkey is an incident in which the fact that social media. Well, Erdogan was able to use FaceTime, but lots of other people were able to use Facebook Live. We saw Facebook Live being used in one of the police shootings in a way that I think really changed a lot of people's ideas.
You're also referring to it being used by Erdogan in Turkey, right?
Erdogan in Turkey. Erdogan used FaceTime. But I think that live video has lots and lots of benefits to our societies as well. They can help promote human rights. They can help people who don't have a voice have a voice. But it has this dark side too.
Can I get Soraya Shamali to come in? Go ahead.
Yeah, I think the thing that's those of us who use these tools every day that's so integrated into our lives, we depend on them, and they're really critical, as Cindy just said, for all of these reasons. But there are two things that really stand out to me in these conversations. One is moderation is a function of brand. These companies are really careful about their branding, and their approach to moderation reflects their protection of that investment. And opening the floodgates to either all content or to allowing users to decide content is in tension with that. And the second point about that is that pornography is being held at bay with these moderation techniques on some of these platforms. And if these platforms become flooded with pornography, which has been a driving force of the development of the internet, then you go back to this question of who are these audiences going to be? Who do they want to develop as long-term life stage audiences for a wide variety of products? Because very often they're not just thinking in terms of one product, right? They're thinking of horizontal and vertical integration of multiple products and the way the data works across those products. And so this question of opening up the tools and giving users more flexibility, which I also agree is very important, becomes mired in all of those complexities.
Let me bring on another caller while we have a couple minutes here. Dorothea, that's you. Hi, welcome.
Oh, hi, good morning. I appreciate the complexity of this issue. It's astonishing how, you know, it's huge. But these companies are making money, supposedly, on all of this free speech. And so it is their responsibility to make sure that we don't have hate speech, that we don't have incitement to murder, which is going on here, I'm sure, because, you know, we could even have a race war soon based on what's been going on. And one of your guests mentioned Israel. You know, they have the Palestinians inciting people to kill Jews. So I think, you know, governments and communities have a right to get rid of that speech. But these companies are making money. They're the ones who be responsible for doing all this moderation, even though it's very difficult. Also, our police forces are mired in their own issues, and how are we going to have them really, and you know, moderate this for us? Also, who's going to pay for that? Why should a private company that has hate speech that needs to be moderated by the police be paid for by our tax dollars? The police can't do that, and we really shouldn't have that burden on us. So what do you think of that whole issue? When you go to do a lawsuit because you've been defamed, it's very costly. How does the average person do that?
Dorothea, you said how complex this is, and your comments even add to the complexity, but I thank you for it. I think we've certainly explored in a very nuanced way, and I hope in depth, just how complicated and how multidimensional this issue is. And we've been talking with Soraya Shamali, director of the Women's Media Speech Center, Speech Project, Cindy Cohen, executive director of the Electronic Frontier Foundation, and Arti Shahani, who is NPR's tech reporter. And you, our listeners, you can continue this online. Go to kqed.org/forum, and Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Gucci, and Tina Larberg. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer, Amanda Stupak. Senior editor is Dan Zoll, and executive producer Joanne Wallace. Thank you for listening. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.